You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Two men walking up a hill, one disappears and one's left standing still. Whether someone hears that first as a Larry Norman melody or, like me, one discovered it on the Jesus Freak single by DC Talk, the image has its roots in a certain reading of certain passages of certain books of the New Testament, called alternatively dispensationalism or end times interpretation or rapture theology. These ways of reading have their ebbs and their flows, taking modern form in the early 19th century, reappearing with the trumpets of the Second Great Awakening in American church history, and eventually surfacing again in the 1970s and 1990s as popular books of the Cold War and post-Cold War era brought them back to popularity. And for those most deeply immersed in them, these kinds of reading have lasting psychological effects, even when people who stop reading them that way or stop reading the Bible entirely go on with their lives. It's that last phenomenon, this psychological phantom that remains after the teaching departs, that Dan Koch is exploring in his psychological research and in his recent podcast episodes. You can find these episodes on his You Have Permission podcast, and their episodes 50 through 53. Today on Christian Humanist Profiles, he's going to talk with us about some of that research. Dan, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Nathan, thank you for having me, and what an eloquent opening essay that was.
And also, Dan, before we get too deep into rapturous things, congratulations are in order. Would you mind telling us listeners about recent changes in the Koch household?
Oh my gosh, yeah, I woke up at 11:30 a.m. today for our noon taping because we have a 16-day-year-old. His name is Soren, and we're very happy and very tired. And really, you could thank me for being here, but we should be thanking my wife for taking care of him while I'm here.
Yes, that's indeed. Yes, story. Indeed. Yes, I can. I have no objection to that, Dan. Well, Dan, you know, our listeners might not listen to your podcast. I recommend that they go do. But I usually don't start with author biographies on this show. But the You Have Permission miniseries, End Times Anxiety, emerges both from your podcasting over the last 4 years, give or take, and from your recent venture into graduate education. So tell our listeners a little bit about both those backgrounds and how those streams have come together to give us this podcast series.
Yeah, so the short history of my podcasting is I'm good friends with the guys who do the Bad Christian podcast out of Seattle and Nashville, and I was a frequent guest on their show, and then I recognized that I wanted to do this myself a few years back. I did a political podcast called Depolarize that was kind of about finding common ground and reducing polarization, so you know that that was a success. And then that's a joke, by the way.
Yeah, I caught it. I caught it. I was going to say I rather liked the podcast, but then I realized, oh, you're saying that people still yell at each other. So yes. Carry on.
No, I did. It was a success insofar as it was a great learning experience, and it made me probably a lifelong moderate. And then I did a show called Reconstruct with my buddy John Raines, and that's where you and I met at a theology beer camp that Trip Fuller put on. I don't know, a few years back, 3 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And then he moved to L.A., and we stopped doing that, and so I started doing You Have Permission. But I think the interesting thing is less the history and more that these episodes are kind of like a model that I'm trying out, which is like instead of writing a book or a book proposal, I have started just doing like podcast miniseries to like see what's working and to play around with ideas, and it's something that I plan on continuing. I'm working on a couple other, actually like three other such series right now, kind of in the background, and it's an interesting idea. So that's kind of the format of it, and then the content, well, I think next you're going to ask me something a little bit about my own stories. Part of it is my own story that I had this kind of anxiety growing up. But the other part is that I've just been hearing these stories from people, and I have been studying psychology. So I'm in my first year of a doctorate of counseling psychology. And, this is at the moment my dissertation topic. So that's kind of how those two things combine. So I will be speaking to the psychology, but I'll try mostly and just speak about my own, you know, beginning research and not speak for all of the psychological world because I don't have that kind of expertise yet.
Well, I think usually when people talk about research, they talk about their own rather than trying to encompass an entire field.
True.
So that's
true.
All right. We already mentioned it. So, I mean, talk a little bit about your own history with these ideas. I'll go ahead and say that in my own story, you know, I am a little bit young to remember the Hal Lindsey boom. But I had already taken some academic biblical studies courses when Left Behind got big. So, you know, I'm going to, you know.
Fortunate.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, because you are younger than I am, you fell in a different place on that timeline. So tell your story a little bit.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that I got on the train. I would say I was thrown onto the train, which was moving at full speed in sixth grade.
How very Heideggerian.
Yeah, when a adult at my sort of Anglican but like conservative Christian sixth grade, you know, whatever it was, like a K-6 school, gave me a copy of a book called 96 Reasons Why Christ Will Return in 96. And this was
– I have seen this book in a used bookstore.
Oh, you've seen the 96 version?
I really have. Well, here's a little story for our listeners. When I was in college and seminary in East Tennessee, there was a used bookstore whose owner had a bit of a perverse sense of humor. And so he collected, you know, books, you know, why – and I think it actually began with 88 Reasons Why the World
exactly.
Will End in 88. But
yeah.
Every such numbered book he kept on a shelf in order so that you could
oh,
see why the world would end in every successive year. It was really, really kind of a glorious little bit of performance art.
That's incredible. I'm going to have to get the name of that store for you because I have not been able to find this online, and I have wondered if it was a fiction, but been pretty sure it wasn't. The 88 Reasons was such a massive, like, a massive selling pamphlet, basically. It was like a pamphlet-length book. It was sold for a dollar or whatever in 1986, 87, 88, that that sort of overwhelms all the Google searches when you try and find it.
Right,
But I remember the cover. I mean, I have a memory of it, and certainly if it had been 1988, it would not have bothered me. The fact was, this was April of 1996. I would have been 12, and Christ was supposed to return in about 5 months in September. So it freaked me out. It sent me into a tailspin. I had panic attacks nightly for a month or two. It's worth noting, I think, that I had already had panic attacks a few years earlier. So I was, you know, I didn't have language for it yet, but I've had panic disorder basically my entire life, at least since third grade or so. That's the earliest I can remember, but that might not be the earliest instances of it. So that's how I got thrown into it in an incredibly disruptive way. And then eventually – and that led to basically the single largest trigger topic for panic attacks in my life. Starting in sixth grade, eighth grade, we did a study on the end times in my, again, Christian junior high. And then in college, I finally read a book by an amillennialist who at the time for me argued convincingly that that was a better view than this premillennial dispensationalism. I wouldn't hold to a lot of the arguments that he made at the time. He thought that, you know, basically all the end time prophecies were written before the destruction of the temple and that the destruction of the temple was a fulfillment of them. I would probably say the author was using the destruction of the temple from the past as a whatever metaphor for the future. At any rate, it still stuck around with me. And in 2007 at 23, I had maybe the biggest panic attack of my life around some self-proclaimed Antichrist figure in Florida who has since died, of course. And had to like leave the studio. I was co-producing a record for my friend. I had to leave before I did my background vocals. I had to fly home. At the time I was living with my parents because I was in a band. So nobody had their own apartments because we were on tour all year. And that's when I got diagnosed with panic attacks and things got slowly better from there. But that's kind of my personal story with this just, frankly, insane doctrine, insane set of beliefs. Not insane, like, I don't want to demonize people who at the time and place where they were exposed to it, it made sense to them because I think that's real. You mentioned the Cold War. That's one of 10 factors I've uncovered in my own research about why people found it plausible. But in fact, it's pretty baseless. And so that trauma caused to me and others is all the more tragic for how sort of pointless the whole thing was.
Well, if I can ask one more biographical question, I mean, you talk about, you know, this episode happening when you are 23 and already on tour with a band. I mean, is this something you still believed at that point, or had you moved on to other kinds of interpretive strategies for those passages of the New Testament by then?
No, I had moved on, and that's the interesting thing, and that's kind of what's salient about all of this, right, is that, as you mentioned in your intro, I had read an all-millennialist. I was an all-millennialist at that point. I believed we were in whatever the millennium was, and it would end when it ended. Jesus would show up. That'd be that. The dead would rise first, and then the rest of us would meet them. We wouldn't disappear in the rapture before the dead were raised, right? That didn't make sense to me from the text. You know, I would have still been a fairly literal reading of the text would have made sense to me at that point. So I had moved on, and I literally had what I would now say a better interpretation of the text, not the exact one I have today, but it was definitely more robust. And yet still the latent issues and like there are biological things here, right? So I was drinking a lot of caffeine, and that sets one up for panic attacks. And I had been feeling anxious and like drinking more caffeine, taking more trips to Starbucks to like stave off the anxiety, which is the opposite of what I wanted it to do. And then I saw this Dateline or 2020 or whatever special it was on this guy, and it just flipped me out. It didn't matter that I didn't believe it anymore.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, I want to hear you talk a little bit about how you set up this series of interviews for You Have Permission for the End Times Anxiety miniseries. How many people did you seek out, and how many interviews did you conduct, and what were the rough demographic ranges? Was it mainly people in their 30s? Was it, you know, a wider range? Were, you know, most of them from the same region? Talk about your study for a little bit.
Yeah, so definitely not any kind of representative sample of Americans. Let's be clear about that. I just put something out on Facebook, on my own Facebook page. I do have people who sort of follow me on there or have befriended me from the podcast work. So I'm sure a lot of the people who answered have listened to one or more of my podcasts, or they were fans of Sherwood, my band. And then a couple of them were actual friends of mine personally. I got enough responses in about an hour that I had to close off. I had to say, guys, I've gotten more than I need. Only contact me now if you have a crazy story that has to be told. I would say the average was like 25 to 40 was about how old they were. Everybody was white except one. I did have one interviewee. She grew up in the black church in New Jersey. And I guess, let's see, they were all over the country, definitely pretty evenly scattered. I found the stories from the South and the Midwest the most interesting because they were the most divergent from my own sort of like California evangelicalism light experience that I was raised with in Northern California. I think that's about all that comes to mind. And I did 20 of them. Yeah, 20 about 40, you know, 30 to 75 minute interviews.
All right, so I mean, all of the people in the study are younger than I am then, which,
yeah.
Thanks for that, Dan. But
there's one or two people that were older. Most of them were under 40.
Okay, yeah. Very good, very good. But one common thread then would seem to be that these are all people who grew up in the age of the Left Behind novels. I already mentioned them briefly. I mean, you know, in 2003, I want to say, might have been 2004, basically at the request of some students I was teaching, I finally read the first of the Left Behind novels just so I could say I've read it and it's terrible. And by the way, I've read it and it's terrible. But I mean, it really wasn't a part of my spiritual journey so much as it was, you know, a matter of conversation with students. I had the same experience, by the way, with the first God's Not Dead movie, which we can talk about later if you want to. But as far as you can tell, I mean, were the Left Behind novels a significant factor in most of these stories, in some of these stories? was it pretty much a marginal phenomenon, or was it really a center of gravity?
Yeah, people actually did have sort of different first impressions or sort of times that they were introduced to this stuff. I would say for my own 20 interviews, I'd say something like off the top of my head, 13 of them had either the Left Behind books or one of the movies as sort of the primary source material. But there was definitely
Kirk Cameron and Nicolas Cage.
Both, but mostly Kirk Cameron because it came earlier.
All right, fair enough.
I know. I think the Nick Cage one was a little bit late. Maybe some of the younger, maybe like the 25-year-olds might have had the Nick Cage one. But like some of them had Thief in the Night and A Distant Thunder, the films from the 70s. One thing that I think I haven't actually talked about this, but it's interesting. For children, movies work better than books. And so I did get a lot of people saying a movie was the first thing that I saw, or a series of videos by a kind of conspiracy-minded preacher about how FEMA camps were being set up for persecuted Christians, which in the 80s and 90s is an insane piece of fiction. So, yeah.
And that's bizarre because I would think that this kind of theology that, you know, is hinging on a sort of, you know, cosmic cataclysm would separate itself somewhat from the movings and shakings of geopolitics or certainly of domestic politics. But in a lot of the stories, when I listen to these podcasts, I mean, they're very tightly linked. I mean, obviously there is some kind of link between the moral majority of the 70s and the religious right of the 90s and whatever's going on with this end times phenomenon. I mean, was there a common thread there, or was it kind of a scattershot?
So I'm going to draw on a little bit of the research I've done. So I'm working on a follow-up series. It'll probably be shorter, maybe just like a two-parter, about why baby boomers in particular like believed this stuff so thoroughly. And one thing that comes up over and over again is the whole point of this way of reading the Bible is that everything is so imminent. That is the selling point. Now, that is, of course, now to us what gives the lie to how bogus it is. Is it just can't be that this, you know, these like highly coded, you know, extinct genre sections of prophetic writings are really aimed at like the Jesus movement of the 1970s in California. There's just no way that's the case, but that is precisely what made it so compelling to people. It's like a way to put you right in the middle of the greatest story ever told, except it's sort of like the worst story ever told for most of the planet. And that, so it's kind of the whole thing. Which I am really fascinated by, and I guess I understand that the pull of that psychologically. If you really thought that was true, you know, my own grandpa was obsessed with the end times, went to his deathbed confident that he would see Christ's return. Of course, he was wrong. He died. But like, what was the pull of that? Like, was that just like too good a drug for him to withdraw from? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes some sense. That makes some sense. And so I want to ask you, Dan, and it's funny, as we were getting ready to record, you kind of objected to my referring to you as a psychologist. But you're more of one than I am, so be the psychologist here for a moment.
Fair.
What are some models that help to account for these things, even if we can't, you know, predict future mutations of it? I mean, what models are out there that, you know, might help to give an account? And as far as you can tell right now, early in the process, what kinds of new ground might your study break as we deal with these phenomena?
Yeah. So I think I don't know what the psychological terminology would be here for how we would describe it. I'm going to kind of slip back and forth between theology and psychology here. So one thing that seems clear to me is that the type of biblical reading that ended up triumphing in the Jesus movement was basically a fundamentalist, you know, a Southern fundamentalist, plenary inspiration, word for word inspiration, read this thing on its face in your own language kind of reading of the text. And we know that that's the one that triumphed because that's the one that's necessitated for this kind of reading, this kind of eschatological view, right? If you're doing math with Daniel and Revelation, then the math can't be approximate, right? The math has to be right. And so if the math is right, then that means it's word for word. There's no translation issues here. This is not like, well, it's a pretty good version of what the, you know, the Apostle John wrote on Patmos. No. None of that's going to do. And so that, I think, is a big part of it. That's a big part of the explanation, is that what people really want is not necessarily knowing when Jesus will come back. That's interesting. And there is, you know, we could talk about the psychology of like sort of death awareness, which we should. So let's put a pin in that. But saving that for a second, what people, I think, really want day to day is I can just pick this Bible up and it gives me the truth for my life and the world around me. And so what's interesting, you know, you were coming of age just after Late Great Planet Earth, but in the introduction to that book in 1970, he says, this is proof for the Bible's truth. You know, this is how we know the Bible is true, that these things have come to pass the way that they were predicted.
And I'll confess, that just blows my mind because, I mean, like I said, I mean, I have a hunch that if you'd asked some of the people with whom I went to church there in the late 80s and the early 90s, I mean, they probably would have held to some of these things, but it certainly wasn't the central focus of what we were doing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. And it kind of slipped. I think it did sort of slip back, and then it came back with the Left Behind series. And then there are some interesting facts, like after 9/11, Left Behind book sales rose by 60% in the weeks following. So there's like some interesting stuff going on psychologically. Let's get into that a little bit. So, I'm speaking a bit out of my depth here, so take everything with a grain of salt. But, you know, the thing that some people think the main thing that separates human beings from other animals is not like our awareness that we will die, our ability to project our death into the future and to sort of ruminate about the fact that we will end. And, we don't think that dogs can do this, for instance. They could be afraid when they see a chainsaw coming at them or a larger dog coming to attack them. They can have the reflexes to fight back or run away, but they aren't sitting there on their doggy bed, you know, when you've given them a bone, being like, man, this bone's good, but I'm also going to die, like a Woody Allen, you know, comic or something like that. They're not doing that. And we are. And so there's ways that we have to deal with that, basically that psychic pressure, the anxiety about our death. And so, you know, I don't know where in the various theories around that, like where this stuff fits in. But there's terror management theory, which basically says that like we want to be a part of transcendent things because that will ease our anxiety. It will make us have some kind of, you know, eternal or ongoing existence in some way. I'm not super up on those. I haven't read any of the original texts of that theory, so I don't want to say too much there. But, you know, there's something about that. And I think, like I said with my grandpa, there was something about being an actor in that play, seeing that play, watching all go down. And if you think about it, if you did do that, that also means you're pretty special. That means that like you're good in God's eyes, which that's a big thing that we could talk about sort of in all these traditions of, you know, once saved, always saved versus not. You know, there are different versions of this of like, how good am I in God's eyes? And almost every single person I interviewed, almost all 20 of them, had moments or seasons where they're praying the prayer over and over again, or they're worrying about their status before God, or something like that. You know, as children, as adolescents, there's something really, really deep when we raise people in a religious community that we telegraph to them, I think both explicitly and implicitly, that their status before God is the most important thing in their life. And if you attach the rapture, you attach hell, you attach some of these really scary stuff to it, that just ups the stakes. And they really got to be good with God. And, you know, I think there's a legitimate question as to whether a childhood or adolescent brain can handle that kind of stuff in a healthy way.
Right. And it's interesting. I mean, I historical particularities, I always tell my students, are always worth attending to. And I think that it's not a coincidence that my high school youth minister was a psychology minor. For him, you're standing before God. I mean, you know, was the most important thing. But, you know, you're standing before God was as someone forgiven, right? And so, you know, I didn't get, you know, heavy, heavy doses of end times, to be sure, but I also didn't get heavy, heavy doses of purity culture or a lot of the horror story kind of stuff that right. a lot of folks did. And actually, Dan, I mean, I don't think I've ever talked about this on any of our podcasts, so you've actually just spurred a thought that yes. I probably need to work with here, because I think that historical contingency right there might explain why I didn't get a heavy dose of some of the horror story stuff that a lot of people in the 90s did.
Your youth pastor, you mean?
Yeah. The fact that, you know, the person who was, you know, guiding me spiritually, first of all, had a good Christian liberal arts education. I've always got to plug that. But then also had done, you know, sustained study of psychology. So, you know, I think his concerns were simply different from what a lot of, you know, ministers of that era were. And actually, that leads me to a follow-up question. I mean, I know that I don't know about your circles. You can tell our listeners about that here in a minute. But I've spent the last 11 years of my professional life teaching at a college with evangelical roots, to be sure, but whose students tend towards a kind of post-evangelical but not necessarily ex-evangelical spirituality rather than the evangelicalism that, you know, I was familiar with in the 90s.
Right.
As far as your research has shown, how prevalent do LaHaye in particular and rapture teaching in general, how prevalent do they remain in those circles?
Yeah, so it's hard to say across the board. But my sense from the interviews and then from the research I've done for that follow-up series and then in speaking to a few friends of mine is that it's almost entirely a generational thing. And the one caveat I'll give is, I'm sure there are still certain denominations, maybe like Church of God of Prophecy or something in Georgia or whatever, where it's still very much a thing. But in the larger stream, you know, take all the mega churches, for instance, whereas in the 90s and early 2000s, the mega churches would have pretty much agreed on the Left Behind eschatology being fairly important. I think that's not the case anymore. It's like it depends how old the head pastor is basically one way of saying it. And for example, I happen to know that in the kind of machinations within Calvary Chapel, for instance, which was really the it's not a denomination technically, but it's the closest thing to Calvary Chapel and Vineyard are the two things that came out of the Jesus movement, at least that were most most closely related to that Jesus movement of the 70s.
Or that at least retained the most, you know, continuous, sustained yes. institutional right. cohesion.
Right. And so within Calvary Chapel, after Chuck Smith died, I don't know, maybe 5 years or so ago, the founder, and he was obsessed with end time stuff. But I know a bunch of younger Calvary Chapel pastors. I just happen to know them through friendships here in Seattle. And they are part of a contingent that's like, yeah, we definitely need to get rid of that. Like, that obviously didn't happen, and that's not helping us. I'm sure the baby boomers in our congregations might still believe that, but it's bad theology. It never happened, and it's not going to help us with the next generation. So that's my sense, is it's pretty much a boomer and above thing almost entirely, except for some pockets of, you know, where a particular kind of denominational lifestyle has a lot of purchase still.
Yeah, that makes some good sense. Now, one thing that was a focus but not the main focus of your interviews, but I want to hear you talk about a little bit, is that I would imagine that turning loose of rapture theology and interacting with people who have never been part of those circles or who might have also left them might create a certain tension between loyalty to one's family, the childhood friends that you grew up with, on the one hand, and then a desire, on the other hand, to distinguish yourself from the old ways. as far as you can tell, Dan, I mean, do people tend to sever ties with family and church? Do they tend to sustain that contact but avoid conversations about end time things? Or, I mean, do the continued interactions, you know, after the intellectual change proceed in some other manner usually? Or is it once again a scattershot?
It's kind of a scattershot. I mean, this is actually really kind of the one of the enduring and perennial questions of most of the listeners of You Have Permission Anyway. This is a question that comes up routinely on our Facebook group, for instance. And I've done a whole episode about it and will do future episodes because
can you tell our listeners that episode number offhand, or do you have it handy?
I do have it handy. Let's see. It would be 40.
Episode All right, very 40. Good. Listeners, because yeah, I remember hearing that one and enjoying it, so listeners, go check that one out.
Yeah, it's about, like, family, kids, marriage, divorce, that kind of stuff. Basically, like, loved ones, right? And dealing with faith change with your loved ones. And so what I find the most is I've been impressed by this. Quite a bit of maturity. Even probably more so than I have in my own dealings with family members and other people close to me, that people are really searching out for a healthy way to do this, and they often will kind of adopt something that I've heard Brian McLaren say that he does about politics living in the South. He'll say, like, you know, that's interesting. I see that differently. And then really not go further unless it's very clear that they're interested in hearing why he sees it differently. But I think there's quite a bit of psychological maturity in recognizing mostly people are not wanting to hear why you changed your mind. They are primarily, at least at first, they're dealing with their own anxiety that somebody has left their tribe. And if you could leave, could they leave? And if they left, what would that mean? And is the tribe getting smaller? Are they embattled? Are they going to be persecuted in some national or local or interpersonal sense? You know, that's like when David Bazan of the band Pedro the Lion, this is my generation here, of like, you know, became a non-Christian and kept making records. It's not like what I first wanted to do was really understand why he didn't and deal with the arguments. Like, I just was anxious. Like, here's a guy I looked up to. He's left. What does that say about me? How do I get rid of this anxiety so that I can go back to equilibrium and live my life again? And so I think that if you can recognize that that's what's going on, well, then you're not going to just sort of like engage willy-nilly or throw a bunch of data at people because you recognize that that doesn't really work. And I've been impressed, frankly, to see this become more of the standard approach for the larger group of listeners. I should say one thing about the interviewees. So everybody I interviewed self-identified as having mental health issues around their end times thought and anxiety and stuff. Anxiety, depression, OCD, PTSD, all four of those came up in the interviews. And it's a bit more complicated for them because a lot of them, their families were really important in their lives and did not believe in counseling or mental health, you know, interventions really of any kind except pray or read more scripture or something like that. And so that's a more complicated situation because now you're basically dealing with a parent or something who has actively contributed to the deterioration of your mental health. And so obviously that's a bit more of a minefield.
Well, and it's interesting because I don't know why this follow-up didn't occur to me before, but you say the people who tend to stick with, you know, the Hal Lindsey mode of existence, if you will, tend to be baby boomers and older, and yet most of the folks you interviewed are, you know, and our listeners know that I'm supremely suspicious of generational labels, but they tend to fall into that range that gets called millennials, right? So I mean,
yeah,
you know,
millennials, Gen X, and then maybe one or two Gen Z, but it's mostly millennials.
Yeah. But I guess my question is, I mean, as far as you can tell, and again, I realize that, you know, the scope of your research is limited, but is it a fairly reliable thing for people, let's say, under the age of 50 to emerge out of that in a way that it wouldn't be reliable for people, you know, in their 50s or 60s to do so?
What do you mean by, what do you mean the way that they emerge out of it?
Oh, so in other words, I mean, you know, if you meet someone, you know, who is under 50, is it, as far as you can tell, more likely than not that end times is something they used to be concerned with, but now they're not?
Interesting. In terms of theologically interested in, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's really hard because I don't, this is where I don't have a good sense because my own circles probably determine some of this. I'm sure there are a bunch of 20-year-olds somewhere at a Baptist Bible college, you know, convinced that the rapture is coming soon and that, you know, the fact that you can use Apple Pay on your, in tap your card or tap your phone, you know, that has some import to what the Antichrist will use. I'm sure those kids exist, but they are not in the mainstream anymore.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Definitely true. Yeah.
Right. And I guess what I had in mind was more along the lines of, you know, are there, you know, Barna Group polls or things like that that indicate a precipitous drop off at
That's
some
a great
point
question.
Historically? Or is yeah. that not something you've researched yet?
I haven't looked into that. I would bet money that that's what the polls show. I mean, it's sort of like it's got to be similar to homosexuality. How, and there's a lot of data about that, that the younger generation, especially Gen Z, they just don't think that that's an issue by comparison. And with each successive generation older than them, they'll Barna or Lifeway or whatever will find a higher and higher percentage finding that to be sort of a crucial doctrinal question.
That's fair enough. And again, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you about Barna polls, and I didn't know I was going to ask you about Barna polls. So
I love me some Barna polls. I use those a lot with depolarize more than you have permission, although occasionally.
Very good. Well, one thing theologically that, you know, if I were, you know, coming to this without having done any research, which I am, you know, I would think that, you know, churches that teach doctrines of, you know, the persistence of the saints, to use the, you know, the Reformed formulation, or once saved, right, always saved, as I often hear in Baptist circles, I mean, do those sorts of things act as a sort of guard against this kind of anxiety, or do those doctrines of election do anything to mitigate the anxiety that comes from rapture teaching?
Yeah, I think they definitely have to have a moderating influence in the positive sense. So, for instance, I was raised California evangelical, and we were not Reformed. It was not a Baptist theology. There was, you know, that wasn't the deal. But we did have that kind of once saved, always saved. That was a part of what I learned growing up. And for me particularly, I had a ton, as you've heard, I had a ton of anxiety about the rapture. Never once worried that I was going to hell. It was not about going to hell. For me, it was about not having the chance to live the rest of my life on earth. And, you know, there's personal, interesting, not totally understood psychological reasons for that. But for me, all my big panic triggers are about cutting things short here on this earth. I don't know exactly why, but that's what they're about for me.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's never about hell for me. And I did find that with people I interviewed, you know, in this small sample, the people who were in Methodist traditions or holiness traditions where there was a lot more emphasis on, yeah, you could lose this. You could be out of God's grace. You can backslide and it can actually have these kind of consequences for you. I did find a greater, you know, anecdotally, I found a greater worry about that, which makes sense, right? For instance, I interviewed one of the older, slightly older people I interviewed is Jim Stump, who is a philosopher and vice president of BioLogos. And he told his own story about the 88 Reasons Why pamphlet, which Nathan, you might remember listening to. There's a really funny bit in his story of where he thought he was left behind, where he was on his Christian college campus and he sees one guy and he's like, frankly, seeing that guy still around didn't give me any kind of assurance.
Yeah,
that the rapture
had happened. I do remember that story. Yeah.
But before that, he said, you know, the theology that he had been given up to that point in his life was that he could get in a car accident and swear as his car is rolling, that's an unforgiven sin. He dies and goes to hell. So there are, that's a pretty extreme version, I think, but that's what he had really gotten from his tradition. And so that does make it worse. That has to make it worse. But one thing I'll say about the election stuff is there are still back doors for all of these traditions. Like what I think that Calvinists often want to say, not in bad faith or anything, but what they want to say is like, no, when you really grasp your election, you're good. Like you're good at a psychological level. And what I would say my research is hinting at is that that's not true. That if somebody is anxious, if they have an anxious temperament, which by the way is pretty much biological, and some of it has to do with the way they're raised and what their parents were like, if they have an anxious temperament, they'll find the back door. So if for instance, you struggle with OCD and your tradition, like mine, said all you have to do is pray the sinner's prayer. That's it. You got your four spiritual laws. You say this. You believe it in your heart. You're good. Well, they'll start doing it 100 times in a row every night that they go to bed. Or they'll do it every night for 4 or 5 years, right, to make sure they got it right. They didn't miss some syllable. They didn't miss some whatever. So there's always a back door for the constitutionally anxious or depressed or OCD, you know? So that's, I think, an important sort of overlay on the theological question.
Yeah, that's interesting. And again, I don't think I've thought this much about my youth minister, Tim Gephardt, in a number of years. So this has been a good conversation. But I do remember, you know, when my great-grandfather started losing his mind, and I wasn't old enough to listen to the official diagnoses, but I mean, you know, he stopped recognizing people. He stopped, he lost, you know, powers of memory, right? And, you know, one of my great worries was that, you know, in his mental state as he approached his end, he wouldn't remember that he was Christian. And I remember, you know, Tim Gephardt saying, you know, I mean, God knows that our brains deteriorate. And so, you know, God's not going to punish someone for that. And, you know, for me, and again, you know, I just feel like, you know, my life is a series of recognitions of what good cards I was dealt. That was enough for me. So, yeah. I mean, you know, I recognize that that's not the case for everyone. So, I mean, I you know, once again, you know, I hope listeners hear gratitude here rather than, you know, a boast.
Sure. Yeah. That's actually really, I mean, permission to maybe use that in the future.
Oh, by all means, man. By all means. I'll listen
that's
to that
really,
show. I love
that's really interesting. That's a really interesting question of like, yeah, well, dementia. Like, would dementia change? Like, you know, people talk about it, and we do not have to go down this rabbit hole, by the way, of like, this is the conversation sometimes between the faithfully LGBT hashtag, you know, Christian, gay Christian celibacy, and the more conservative wing, especially in reform circles, who are like, no, we shouldn't identify as queer. We are in Christ. Like, so this language of like how I identify, how I self-perceive, like what does dementia do to that? And if any kind of my status is hinging upon my self-identification, that would pose a big problem, I guess, not just for dementia, but for people with really reduced mental capacities, either born that way or through traumatic brain injury or something like that. You do run into these like really kind of rough consequences that you don't want, I think, theologically. You don't really want it hinging on self-concept in such a robust way.
Oh, sure, sure. And I mean, this is where, I mean, for all of his faults, and I mean, you know, listeners who want to hear me take pot shots at Martin Luther, we did an episode on my doctoral dissertation a number of years ago. But for all of his faults, I think that one of the things that I most benefited from reading Martin Luther 20 years ago is precisely that notion that, you know, the unilateral salvation of the sinners by Christ is the core of Martin Luther's theology, right? So, I mean, for him, you know, that question would itself reveal that you've missed the point.
Right. And I just like to universalize that out to all creatures, and then I'm good.
Oh, sure, 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 sure. And, you know, a more recent interview, listeners, with David Bentley Hart will
right,
cover that ground. But Dan, one, and I think I want to pose this question to you because I enjoyed Depolarize so much. But to what extent do shifts between theological approaches and loyalty to American political factions coincide? And to what extent do they ebb and flow independent of theology? Or, to put it another way, do people tend to become Democrats when they turn loose of the rapture?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a sociological answer. 100 years ago, 50 years ago, I think people could really go, especially 50 years ago, really like 60, 70 years ago, the height of sort of the Cold War, like mid-century consensus, which as Ezra Klein and others helpfully point out, pretty much excluded non-white people and often non-male people. But during that time, when we were less polarized, identities didn't all overlap. So, yeah, you could be a Democrat who loved hunting. It's almost like I don't know any. The hunters I know in Seattle, the furthest they'll go is, like, independent, right? Like, and this is in a super left urban area. Like, we're right. Just at a point now where all our various identities are just increasingly overlapping with each other. So our religious identity is piled on top of our social, our cultural, our political identity. And those are already piled on each other. So, yeah, what you end up finding is that people who go through deconstruction, well, then they start asking, how firm do I really need to be on abortion? You know, or something I've noticed in myself is I just won't spend as much time thinking about abortion, even though my own intuitions are pro-life. Now, I have procedural questions about that, like, should it be outlawed? What would that lead to? Would it actually reduce abortions? How can we reduce them? I'm usually convinced that Democratic platforms reduce them more than Republican platforms. You know, so that's a complex thing. But I also notice I just don't think about it very much because it causes me cognitive dissonance. And I don't actually have an option. I don't have – there's no like mainstream or sort of like well-worn path for someone like me who has these pro-life sort of intuitions, moral intuitions, but is not a Republican, you know? So it's like there's just not a space. Like that space doesn't even really exist anymore. You can carve it out for yourself. And I think like Alan Jacobs, the Baylor professor and author, has been really helpful for me in this respect that he kind of thinks if you're not carving something like that out in today's day and age, then you're kind of not being honest because if you're just going along with whatever tribe you're in, then you're just going with the flow in the bad sense. And I think he's right about that. At the same time, it takes tremendous effort to continually carve out that space. And I imagine that you understand and probably have felt some of what I'm talking about here.
Oh, sure. And I always vote American Solidarity for president. So I have long since given up on belonging to either of the major political parties. The big difference is 15 years ago, people who were Republicans thought I was a secret Republican, and people who were Democrats thought I was a secret Democrat. And now people who are Democrats are almost sure that I'm a right-wing fascist, and people who are Trump supporters think that I'm a communist.
Yes.
I would say people could write books about that, but they already have. So go read Jonathan Haidt, and you will learn the ways.
Exactly. He's my political psychology patron saint. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. One thing that your interview subjects mentioned on and off through these episodes, and I found just utterly fascinating, is that, you know, in recent years when global climate change, became one of the defining, political divisions, that people who were still, most insistent on rapture theology, nonetheless pulled up short when people said that the world might end, but because of climate change. I mean, is that just pure partisan tribal loyalty rearing its ugly head, or are there other intellectual stews being brewed there?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Frankly, I didn't get as robust of findings on this question as I hoped. I asked it to everybody, and only about 20% of respondents really had heard much from their communities about this. I wonder if that is generational. Like if I was talking to 14-year-olds today, you know, that who are a bit more, you know, they're growing up a bit more in that with that as a cultural force. I'd be curious to hear what they had to say, but I didn't interview any adolescents.
I gotcha. Now, real quick, if I could follow up again and just add another variable to it. I mean, one thing that was definitely on the radar when I was growing up, and then people seem to forget about in 1989, but I didn't, which always freaks me out, is that there are, you know, I forget what I heard recently, 900 nuclear warheads targeted at city limits and the immediate perimeter of Moscow.
Okay.
And that, you know, likewise, there are weapons that could end the human race within the next 72 hours. It seems like that would have some kind of impact on this kind of thinking.
So that did, and this is a bit more on the upcoming research, so about our parents' generation, but that was big. I think that, like, my mom and dad grew up in a world where it was plausible that everybody could die within a couple days. And what climate change doesn't get you is that cataclysm. It's a slow unfolding. It's like a slow suffocation. But it isn't a blaze of glory. And the way that biblical literalists interpret the end of the world is in a blaze of glory, you know, almost literally.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Like, God will burn this up and create a new one. So even though the word burn there is like climate change, and you might think that, oh, so maybe it could be that. That's not what they mean. They don't mean a frog in the pot of water. They mean a blaze, you know, and so the explosions of nuclear weapons are much closer to that than the gradual rising of temperature. I do think there's something really interesting to think about for people of our generation as we raise our children in today's world, though. There's a lesson here for, like, how do we talk about this in a way that does not explode their brains, that does not cause them trauma. One helpful definition of trauma I've heard is like an experience that you have that you can't process or can't make sense of. It's like it's more than your circuitry can handle at that point in your life. And some of those things are that way no matter how old you are. Watching a friend get blown up right next to you in war, for instance, might cause trauma on any brain. But there are things that are only traumatic to children because they're just not ready for them yet. Right. And so how do we talk about the real world that they are growing up in? And I'm sure you've thought about this with your kids being a little older, obviously older than mine. And I'm just starting to think about it. But my son's going to have a quite a bit different world. You know, a 36-year differential on the climate change index is going to be significant given when I was born and when he was born. But how do I not just screw him up the way that I got screwed up around Christ's imminent return, you know?
Yeah, and what I found interesting, and I mean, I don't want to give you even more anxiety about these sorts of things, but, you know, my son's friends and my son are all on Reddit. So the conversations that I tend to have with him are, how do we evaluate, you know, these competing claims when, you know, you've got people who look identical when they appear as a box of text on a Reddit page. You know, how do you judge between the people who say, you know, okay, climate change is all a shell game, and those who are saying, all right, you know, this is rooted in measurements of ocean water temperature and, you know, things that are genuine, you know, systematic, sustained research, right? So it's interesting, you know, I think that there probably are parents out there, you know, who are, you know, keeping their kids away from, you know, the internet as a phenomenon more broadly. But if, you know, for those people out there whose kids are on the internet, you know, probably the most important conversations are not about, you know, the fact that these ideas exist, but how to navigate among them.
That's one of the things that gives me a little bit of hope. I know your youngest is 10. How old is your oldest?
Yeah, my son Micah just turned 15.
Okay. So if you think about the way that, like, your parents use Facebook and sort of, like, you know, think about the misinformation campaigns in 2016 and even how much more savvy most Americans are in the intervening 4 years. Not all. And especially people who are actively wanting to be convinced by anything, you know, are not going to be. But our kids are just going to have to be I don't know what it would have been called in a classic liberal arts education, but it's the kind of thing you'd learn in debate club. You know, it's like reasoning. It's like logic classes.
Oh, sure, sure.
That is just going to have to come back for them. It's going to come back in an organic way because of the kind of stuff that they're exposed to. And in some sense, I think that our kids are going to be better prepared for this than we were, and certainly than our parents, who grew up in an age where pretty much people listened to what the leaders of the institution said.
Right.
And that had a
proverbial
bunch of
status of Walter Cronkite.
Yes. And that had a bunch of benefits. And then when all that broke down and they hadn't, like, they had replaced their own logic with the institution of three networks all competing for moderate votes and moderate eyeballs. And that worked for a while. But that broke down, and now they don't really know how to tell when a lot of them don't know that Hannity is blowing smoke up. They just don't even – they don't know how to tell that. But your 15-year-old could probably watch an hour of Hannity and have a bunch of red flags go up. Or at any rate, you're teaching him how to do that because that's the world that he's growing up in. And that's what he has to learn. That's really not what my parents had to learn when they were teenagers.
Right. Unfortunately, on Reddit, there's worse than Hannity.
Sure.
And, you know, my son at this point, you know, rolls his eyes when I start this bit, although he rolls his eyes at me a fair bit, just generally because he's 15. But, you know, the two rules for internet use in our house is no porn and no fascism. So I, you know, and, you know, I've had to correct him on both of those fronts. And I think that's just kind of parenting in the 21st century.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But he'll also be inoculated early, probably, right? So it's like once you've heard, you know, okay, so for instance, anarcho-fascist punk rockers. That was one of the first ones I was able to put the lie to because I was a punk rock kid. And for a little while, I was kind of taken in by that. I was like, oh, maybe this whole thing is just, and like, we need to go back to the land or whatever. And then like, that's the one that I'm like the least persuaded by now, right? Because I saw that one early. I recognized that it was more about fashion than ideology. And so you get inoculated to the stuff that you end up coming into contact with. And you know, that's not to say everything's going to be hunky dory, but there is a kind of a self-correction inherent in the system, I think.
Right, right. Well, Dan, since we're already talking about this, I mean, what other practices at this stage in your research would you recommend for Christian communities? Because from what I'm hearing and from what I heard on your podcast, you know, the pervasive reach and influence of rapture teaching doesn't have the power that it had 20 years ago, 25 years ago. But what kinds of things would you recommend for Christian communities now as we face new possibilities for these catastrophic ideas?
Yeah, a related topic is just sort of spiritual authority and abuse of that authority in general. And there is more and more research and literature coming out about that. And if you want to think about a lot of the trauma that came to light in the conversations that I had were really of that sort. And just the content happened to be end time stuff. But there are stories about like, hey, you know what? Those kind of questions aren't helpful to be asked in these group scenarios. Well, what's that? That's spiritual bullying, basically, especially if someone's asking questions about the text. And what you end up finding in those kind of situations is that spiritual leaders, pastors, youth pastors, whomever, are privileging a reading that they have been given, and they're ignoring other readings. They're ignoring alternate views. And this is something that has come up over and over and over again talking to people who listen to the show in general. You know, I have an episode on atonement theories. It's called, you know, All the Atonement Theories or something like that. And people are like, I didn't know there were atonement theories. I knew there was one, and that was the gospel. And just highlighting the fact that there are different ones is like 50% of the battle for a lot of people. And it also does major diffusion work on spiritual authority. In fact, what it does is it increases the authority of the Christian leader who's able to contextualize his or herself in the broader tradition and say, hey, this is what our church teaches. This is what I find plausible. Then someone goes, oh, so you're not pulling the wool over my eyes. You're not being a narcissist here. You're actually just genuinely seeking the best for me out of your own place. So I think that's a step. So that could, if in a church context, that might be like adult Sunday school classes that go through one of those Four Views books from Zondervan or something like that. And anything like that, that sort of brings around stuff that anything that the church considers a non-essential, you know, the four or five sort of closest doctrinal claims that make them who they are, everything else is non-essential. And it would be good to show that, to basically broadcast that. And then we can inoculate our congregations against the kind of people that would, you know, bullishly claim their own particular way. But the thing is, the people who listen to your show, I'm probably preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, that's probably fair enough. And you know, again, I just remember one of the places where, you know, I was just dealt a very good hand in life because I started taking Christianity seriously, you know, kind of in my mid to late teen years, you know, 15, 16 years old. And then by the time I was 18, I was at Milligan College where, you know, I was hearing a lecture, for instance, and they say you don't remember lectures from college. Well, I do. But I heard a lecture, you know, tracing the differences between, you know, patristic Christus Victor theologies and ransom theologies, and then as they developed through Anselm and eventually through Abelard, and, you know, we got this, you know, very compact, you know, 60-minute version of different ways that people deal with, you know, the claim that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, right? And so that plurality and that possibility for difference, I mean, has just been part of my consciousness from a very early point. So I think it's fascinating that, you know, I mean, that is one of the factors that makes the biggest difference, it seems, as you've discovered things.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like it's kind of the whole ball game. For me, it's really, I'm recognizing more and more that the common thread around all the public work that I have wanted to do and all the stuff that I have found most helpful reading in other people, you know, since my 20s or whatever, has been around theological or intellectual humility. That's the ballgame for me. And that's where my, you know, we don't have time to get into all this. That's where my pluralism comes from. That's where my moderate, political moderateness comes from. It's all just like, oh, man, this stuff is complicated. It's very hard to carve nature at its joints, as the scientists like to say. It's just difficult. And especially with like a religious text written by, you know, 60 or so different people over time, it's just hard. And we're just fooling ourselves, and worse, we're fooling and manipulating others when we ignore the complexity. That's a very deep question, a deep well. What are the psychological needs for that? How much ambiguity can a group live with and still be a group? I mean, these are really hard, interesting questions, and that relate to people's flourishing. And I don't know the answers to that. But it seems that almost all groups could do with at least some more intellectual, theological humility. I think that probably Unitarian Universalism is too far for most people. That will not constitute for them a meaningful group that brings the kind of benefits that religious communities bring. But some more humility seems like it's almost always good.
Very good. Well, Dan, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I want you to have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about mental trauma, the end times, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Yeah, I think I would just encourage people to listen to the episodes. This has been a fantastic conversation. I've been able to sort of you've given me the opportunity to kind of verbalize and synthesize a lot of this, but it does not, I don't think, substitute for actually hearing people tell their own stories. And that's what makes these episodes different than the rest of my show, is just letting people tell those stories. Most people have heard some aspect of their own story in those stories, whether or not this was their issue, you know, whether or not mental health is their thing or end time stuff is their thing. There are just common psychological threads, and it's helpful to hear other people do it. So yeah, just check out You Have Permission. You can start with those episodes 50 through 53, or whatever topic catches your fancy.
Dan Koch, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it, Nathan.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and for listening in. If you want to listen to those interviews, they are episodes 50 through 53 of the You Have Permission podcast. They're called End Times Anxiety as a mini-series, and I strongly recommend them. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.